Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
You have successfully downloaded the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Nice going. Today, Andrew Bacevich returns to our program. Retired Army colonel, retired professor of history, Boston University, prolific author, a military man who is a critic of our post-9/11 military misadventures. And today, an unusual piece that he published at Tom Dispatch on July 23rd. It's a future retrospective, looking back at today from the future. And it's not that pretty, but it's written in an amusing style that I think drives home some powerful points. That we are ignoring climate change and the decline of our empire because of our military misadventures. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. Great people like Andrew Rush, Brian Massey, Stuart Russell, and Elizabeth Vasquez. You can join their ranks. Visit peterbcollins.com. Click on menu. Click on become a subscriber. You hit the sign up page. And I think you know what to do from there. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, Colonel and Professor Andrew Bacevich returns to our program. His most recent book is The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Colonel Bacevich was teaching history at Boston University. Are you emeritus now, or are you still teaching?
No, I actually retired 5 years ago.
You did.
Hard for me to believe all that time's gone by, but I am a retiree.
Now, in the piece that we're going to talk about today, published at Tom Dispatch, it describes you as co-founder of the Quincy, or Quincy, if we use the Boston pronunciation, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm happy to. So the Quincy Institute, just now coming into existence, we've had our so-called soft launch, but we won't really open for business until this fall, is a think tank. It is a transpartisan think tank, meaning we are neither of the left nor of the right. We welcome support from across the political spectrum. We've got funding that comes from both the left and the right. And we intend to take on the blob, that term that's been applied in recent years to the foreign policy establishment. We think that the blob is over-militarized. We think the blob engages in reckless and unnecessary and unsuccessful military interventions around the world. We think that the blob has lost the capacity to appreciate what diplomacy is and can do. And so we're going to offer an alternative vision for foreign policy. And we hope that people in Washington and around the country will notice, and maybe we'll be able to do some good.
And who are some of your co-conspirators?
It is a small Politburo, as I like to call it at this point. But I think the instigator is Trita Parsi.
I know Trita.
A wonderful, smart guy who made his name, I think, in supporting the passage of the Iran nuclear deal. A young guy named Stephen Wertheim. He's a historian, PhD, currently a visiting assistant professor at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Eli Clifton and his wife, Mei Yi. Eli is a journalist by trade. We've got Suzanne DiMaggio, who, she's our chairman, and she has made quite a reputation in sort of, you know, track two diplomacy, sort of the unofficial contacts between antagonists that can lay the basis for official discussions about how to work in tactical problems. She has been involved for a long time, for example, in discussions in the Korean Peninsula, to try to figure out how to end that division. So we are the team that has organized this thing. We're now in the we've done a reasonable job of raising money. We could always use more, of course. We're in the process now of advertising for staff. So we'll be making decisions to hire people within the probably by September. Any of your listeners who are interested in either supporting us or perhaps applying for positions should go to the Quincy Institute website. You can find it easily, and I'll tell you what to do. But it's frankly, for an old retired guy like me, it's this is pretty exciting. And the most exciting part is being involved with these young people who are just so bright and so energetic and passionate and idealistic. I mean, to use a term that sometimes doesn't seem to fit very well in the age of Trump. So I think it's an exciting proposition.
And I'm excited for you. I look forward to seeing the work that you produce, and it does seem like a very interesting group. Trita Parsi is the only one I'm really familiar with. He teaches at Georgetown, and he has been a great voice on policy toward Iran, which is a topic I do want to cover with you today.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you're staffing up, and one person I'd like to single out and promote is Danny Serson. I don't know if you have been...
I know Danny.
And have you been reading?
Of course I read him. I've met him. And he is definitely on our radar screen. I mean, I'm not just saying that.
Good.
We got him in our gun sights.
Okay.
Yeah, he's, a wonderful person, among other things, but also, a good writer and kind of a savvy observer of our military fiascos.
Well, and if I may, I only met Danny a couple of months ago, had a great interview with him, but I've been reading him for as long as he's been publishing.
Yep.
And I feel that you and he share similar worldviews, an appreciation for history, a reticence for dispatching troops when diplomacy and other methods should be used first. And I really think that there's a lot of common vision and common ground between you two.
I think you have us pegged, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well,
he's also just a genuinely nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's fun to be with. Makes you feel good.
So I've been reading you for quite a while, too, Andrew Bacevich, and you're generally quite sober, fact-based, in the present and looking at history. And you kind of broke from that with a piece that was published at Tom Dispatch on July 23rd, and you call it The Great Reckoning, and I would thumbnail it as a future retrospective. You're looking at the present tense from a lens in the future, and I think you did an excellent job. What drove you to do this, and how long has it been kind of... percolating in your brain?
Well, do you know Tom? Have you had Tom Engelhart on your show?
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. So, well, then, if you know Tom, for those of your listeners who may not know Tom, he is a remarkable talent. And I think Tom just turned 76. He is a ball of energy. And I contribute to Tom Dispatch with some regularity. And Tom will call me, and he'll say, hey, when are you going to write something for me? And I'll say, well, Tom, I don't have any ideas. So he and I'll proceed to have a 15 or 20-minute conversation, and by the end of it, I'm signing up to write something because he has so many ideas, and he's also very persuasive. So the answer to your question is that the genesis of that piece was a conversation between me and Tom, where he wanted me to do something, and I think substantively, the genesis of the piece is a concern that he has and that I share, although I think he is more passionate about this than I am, in which we are troubled by the either inability or unwillingness of the American people broadly and our political class more specifically to get serious about things that are serious, that do pose challenges to our country. And I think Tom believes, and I've come to believe, that climate change is probably preeminent in that list. So here we are in 2019, where we're talking about getting rid of plastic straws, and the world's oceans are awash with plastic, killing the fish. We are ingesting plastic because it's gotten into the food stream.
Mm-hmm.
We're experiencing these unbelievable bouts of intense weather, 108.7 degrees yesterday in Paris.
Right.
And yet there does not seem to be an adequate appreciation of what the hell's going on. Instead, we worry about Trump, and I'm not a Trump supporter, and I wish he weren't our president, but I really don't think I don't think Trump poses a danger to the Republic, but some of these other things do. So we began this piece by trying to take the vantage point of a future historian, 80 years from now, trying to commenting on the lack of awareness demonstrated by the American people back circa 2019, when they ought to have been able to recognize the dangers that were coming down the pike, and yet did not, and did almost nothing. So it's speculative and supposed to be kind of funny in a way, but not altogether funny.
Well, it is amusing, and I want to give you credit for that, because in your past writing, I don't think you've really attempted humor. You do take swipes at people who like craft beer, and I was in a place like that just last night. Small batch bourbon.
Well, I like craft beer. I mean,
farm to table restaurant.
But there are other things in life.
You took a swipe at fantasy football. the professor, and I use that title because you expanded my vocabulary, I had to go and look up the word anomie. And you describe here an epidemic of anomie affected a large swath of the population. Help us understand what you mean.
Well, and I don't want to be unfair to our fellow citizens, but I do think that there probably is more attention paid to craft beer and, all these fancy bourbons and betting on sports games than to critically important issues that really demand that we should get serious about modifying the American way of life in order to ensure the sustainability of the planet and in order to demonstrate that we care about our grandchildren enough that they will have a planet that is livable. And there's nothing wrong with craft beer. But I think that our priorities are misplaced. And this is kind of a half joking way to point that out. Not that me writing about it's going to do any good. But
and here's a trivial sidebar at the craft brew place where I had dinner with my son and partner last night. I was pointing out that the Trump administration claims the growth of craft beer as expansion of manufacturing in the United States. And at the place we were dining at, there is a brewmaster. He does the manufacturing. Everybody else is serving or, preparing food or, greeting people. But all of them count as having expanded the population that's participating in manufacturing.
I guess that's one way to look at it.
Now, I want to help our listeners because I had to look up anomie. It is defined as a condition in which society provides little moral guidance to individuals and evolves from conflict of belief systems and causes breakdown of social bonds between an individual and the community. In a person, this can progress into a dysfunctional ability to integrate with normative situations of their social world. And you write, in the midst of what commentators were pleased to call the information age, most ordinary Americans showed a pronounced affinity for trivia over matters of substance. A staggering number of citizens willingly traded freedom and privacy for convenience, bowing to the dictates of an ever-expanding array of personalized gadgetry. What was then called a smartphone functioned as a talisman of sorts, the electronic equivalent of a rosary or prayer beads. I like that. Especially among the young, separation from one's phone for more than a few minutes could cause acute anxiety and distress. The novelty of social media had not yet worn off, with its most insidious implications just being discovered. That's very well written, I have to say, and I think it captures our moment quite well.
Well, and it also reflects my personal biases. I don't have a smartphone, so I'm one of the last six people in America that does. My wife being one of the other five, and I just have become very conscious. And this is a prejudice on my part of the way that those devices take over our lives. We allow them to. It is a form of addiction, and there are many people writing about this now. I saw something the other day that parents of Silicon Valley tycoons are among the most restrictive when it comes to setting the rules for their children being on the web or accessing social media. In other words, the people who are the inventors of this and who have made themselves incredibly rich are in the forefront of recognizing the downside. And I suspect that our awareness of the downside is going to increase over time. And I made a reference to privacy there, too. I mean, it is one of the most striking developments of the last quarter of a century, and this is not simply an Internet-related thing, but how we have acquiesced in having our privacy compromised, both by corporate entities and by the state, in ways that we think may enhance our personal safety, certainly enhance or provide conveniences, but I'm not sure that we really understand the implications.
Yeah.
And I'm bothered by that, and so that was kind of an offhand reference to that concern as well.
Well, and Professor, I'm very concerned about the widespread use of facial recognition software.
Yeah.
And the latest version of the Apple iPhone, the X, uses your face to open the phone. And a lot of people think, wow, well, that's secure. Nobody else can open my phone. But there's a journalist named Seth Harp who writes for Rolling Stone, and he was traveling from Mexico to Austin, Texas, and he wrote a piece about this published at The Intercept. His treatment by the Border Patrol was so excessive. They looked at his phone. They checked his contacts. They were looking at articles that he had written. And they detained him for several hours without arresting him, so he didn't have the right to call an attorney. And it was one of those frightening episodes. But I, for one, don't want my phone to be based on my picture, because I know that at that border crossing, the goon can hold up my phone to my face and open my phone without my permission. And so I also noted on a recent trip, I went to Europe a few weeks ago during the preceding heat wave, and they got a picture of me at the airport in Amsterdam, in Frankfurt. I had a stopover in Calgary. The Canadians have a picture of me, a fresh one. And then to enter the United States, I had to submit to a fresh photograph that was then compared to one with the one in my passport file.
Yeah.
And I find this really creepy.
Well, I have to agree with you. And I suppose that government agencies would say that this is all being done in order to keep you and your fellow travelers safe, you know, to make sure that nefarious individuals are not allowed access to our country, to those countries. But I'm with you. I mean, it is a form of electronic totalitarianism, creeping totalitarianism. It happens incrementally, but the long-term implications to me are troubling, and certainly you're not getting the kind of attention they ought to.
Now, Professor, one of the things that I need to note with firm praise is that in this entire piece, you don't mention Russiagate, Bob Mueller, or any of that hoo-ha. And I want to congratulate you on your judgment there.
Well, this is another one of my sort of things that I really I think Trump is the worst president we ever had. He's totally unqualified to be president. I will be as happy as anybody else when he departs the office. But I have been arguing. This is one of the themes of a book I have coming out in January, that we pay way too much attention to the president and what he says. What he does, all the shenanigans. And because we pay so much attention to him, we end up not paying sufficient attention to problems that predate his presidency that he may have exacerbated, but really he didn't event. I mean, I think an example here is our penchant for war and armed intervention, which Trump, of course, in running for the presidency in 2016 was highly critical of this penchant for intervention. You know, he called the Iraq War one of the greatest disasters in our history, and he's right. He promised to end the Afghanistan War, which, of course, he has not done. But the extent to which we just the media they hammer away at Trump himself, it seems to me we take our eye off of things that are far more important. And my half-humorous piece was suggesting that when a historian is examining the present period from the perspective of, let's say, 2100, that as a historian tries to make sense of what was occurring around the time of 2019, Trump is not going to be a big part of the story. Going to be some of those other things that I mentioned in the piece.
Well, and hopefully Twitter will be an artifact of little consequence, 50 or 100 years from now. But I want to underscore that in this piece, you maintain your voice as a military veteran and a man, who served our country with some distinction. Your critique of the post 9/11 regime change wars, and also your firm understanding of the risks of climate change. And I want to mention two important people who I've interviewed this year related to climate change. One offers a more hopeful perspective. She is an architect from New York, Vanessa Keith. And she published a book called 2100, A Dystopian Utopia. And with a team of architects, they essentially took the data points of what climate change is likely to produce. They used an assumption of 4 degrees by 2100. And they figured out that the livable cities will be Vancouver and Moscow and those that are on that meridian. And that we have to reconfigure the entire Earth. California will be partly underwater and the rest of it will be a desert. And so the unlivable parts of the planet will be where we try to extract renewable energy, but they won't be able to sustain a population. The other interview, which is much more dire, was with Guy McPherson. And he
Hang
is
on a second. Hang on a second. The first book was the optimistic take?
Yes.
Oh, jeez.
Guy McPherson, who is kind of the bad boy of climate science, he is retired from the University of Arizona, and he argues that human extinction may begin as soon as 2030. And while many people think that that's extreme, and I understand that, I think it's important for people to understand the wide range here and the potential for acceleration of heating of the planet because of the melting of permafrost and other factors that can exponentially increase the rate of impact of climate change. Right. And so whether you take the 2100 view or the 2030 view, we clearly have to come to grips with this. And in your piece, you point out that that is very far from our top agenda item.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a close observer of our politics, and in particular of the the beginning of the campaign for 2020. But I do think that the contest thus far exemplifies the problem. I mean, there is discussion about climate change. It's not like people are just totally ignoring the subject. But nobody really wishes to come to grips with it. Nobody wants to confront Americans with the need to change the way we live. I'm not sure if somebody did make that case that they would win the election, but it might be a useful wake-up call.
Mm-hmm. Well,
education.
Governor Jay Inslee of Washington has made climate change his central focus. And Tom Steyer, the billionaire activist from San Francisco, has jumped into the race on a climate change agenda. But the coverage doesn't reflect their initiatives very much. And we know that the networks have flatly turned down proposals to hold a debate that is only focused on climate change. And the DNC supported that. There are many ways that this is.
I did not know that, and that is a fascinating fact. In other words, somebody said, "Hey, we really ought to focus on this one issue," and the network said no.
And the DNC told Governor Inslee specifically that if he participated in an unapproved debate that was focused on climate change, that he would not be invited to future group groups of the Democratic candidates.
I did not know that, and I can't tell you how appalled I am and discouraged by that.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's because if you're in the DNC, you're trying to calculate what do we need to do to win, and so let's not upset people too much. Let's just talk about what a jerk Trump is, and he certainly is a jerk.
But those calculations they are so misplaced, and the idea that Democrats can run a safe, focus group tested campaign and defeat Trump is just idiocy. And that's why when I hear all of this talk about how, the Democrats are moving too far left and this is going to just ruin everything and guarantee Trump a second term, I think if they don't provide enough of a distinct policy path forward that is far separate from Trump, and they're going to be called socialists no matter what they do. And they act as if they can just duck and, feint and use the right language to avoid riling up independent voters. And frankly, I just think that's bullshit.
Well, it's gutless, too, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I feel the same way about impeachment. I understand the mechanics. I understand the votes aren't there in the Senate. But I think there is a duty to impeach when you look at the obstruction of justice and when you look at the Michael Cohen plea deal. There is a very clear case of criminal behavior there. And to overlook it and to say, well, this is not going to help Democrats. I mean, Pelosi imagines that ducking impeachment is going to allow her to hold on control of the House. And in a series of tweets about race and the squad, Trump can turn the tables on the Democrats related to the House races in a moment or two.
Yeah, I all I can say is I agree, and I mean, the Nancy Pelosi's calculations are naked. I mean, it's right up front.
Yep.
All that matters is whether or not Democrats hold the House and she continues to be Speaker. But whether or not any of that somehow contributes to the common good is just is an irrelevant consideration, I guess. And you know, the media, the big newspapers and the networks, they report on her calculus.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that basically endorses it. You know, this is the way politics gets played. These are necessary actions. And anybody who dissents from that is somehow doesn't understand the way the game gets played.
Right. She's the savvy, wise elder, and those of us who don't agree with her are idiots.
Are naive.
Yeah. Well, let me turn to get your comments on a few things. The Democratic House has approved a budget with even more money for the Pentagon at a time when Trump is stoking for military conflict with Iran and secondarily appears to have eased off any interest in military action in Venezuela. But I'm very concerned that John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and Elliot Abrams on the Latin American front could push him into military action. And the Democrats have provided the funding and opposition to either one of those gambits.
Yeah, but I mean, first of all, we have to emphasize it's more money for the Pentagon and it's more money for everybody else, too.
Yeah.
So we are, you know, we either will have this year or next year, I don't know which, we'll be back in the range of trillion-dollar deficits. We had trillion-dollar deficits for a while under Obama, but that was because we were in the midst of the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. Now we're supposedly, the good times are here, with unemployment very low, and yet even the Republicans, who are ostensibly the party of fiscal discipline, have simply rolled over, and I happen to believe in fiscal discipline, and they're just, you know, the federal deficit. I heard the other day we're going to spend $350 billion in the next fiscal year just to service the debt.
Mm-hmm.
$350 billion, poof, gone. So that'd be my point number one. Point number two, with regard to more money for the Pentagon, and by the way, Trump promised when he was running for the presidency to balance the budget.
Oh, yeah.
He said it would be easy. So that promise has gone away.
Crown Prince Jared's working on it. He's got
a
plan.
So more money for the Pentagon. But the question, so are we headed for a war with Iran, I guess, is the primary, most likely scenario. I don't know, but if I had to put money on it, I would say no. And I'd say that despite recognizing that people like Bolton are eager for war, because they believe that through war we achieve regime change in Iran, and for whatever reason, they seem to think that once we've got the Ayatollahs out of power, that Iran will become what? A liberal democracy? A friend of the United States? I don't know. I don't know why they could possibly think that after the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan. That said, I don't think we should overstate Bolton's influence. Trump himself mocks his national security advisor in public. As a warmonger, I don't think Trump wants war. The problem is there. I think that Trump really doesn't know what he wants. I mean, he is not somebody with a coherent foreign policy vision.
Indeed.
He is somebody who acts on impulses.
Mm-hmm.
He's somebody who talks big and often then, rarely, in fact, acts on big talk, and
right.
We should be grateful for that.
Indeed, I agree.
He's not somebody who has anything like a coherent worldview and a sense of how American power should be used to advance the interests of the United States. So if we go to war, and I certainly hope we don't, It'll be because of an impetuous response to some unintended act, event, incident in the Persian Gulf, where he flies off the handle. So I hope that won't happen. And I the reason I think it won't is because at some level, he does oppose the continuation of these wars, even though he has no idea how to actually extricate us from the ones he inherited from his predecessors.
I take that point, and I agree. I think that instinctively he has shown at least flashes of this kind of restraint and an awareness of the failure of the military debacles that we have been and are still engaged in. But because of his willingness to bluff big and to bluster, about wiping nations off the face of the earth, Afghanistan was most recently the recipient of that loving message. But people believe that he actually had Iran on his mind and the war plans that have been shared with him for that prospect. And so it is very difficult, and I would add to the mix of mercurialness Boris Johnson, now running the United Kingdom, and they have been a lackey to the U.S. in many of our recent misadventures, and it remains to be seen where Johnson will fall when Trump decides, for example, to try to at least rhetorically confront Iran again.
Johnson is another one of these characters. It's exceedingly difficult to predict how they will behave. But that said, he's not a dictator. He's a prime minister in a cabinet form of government. So he has to sit around with his colleagues and gain some kind of concurrence for doing things. And when he sits down with those colleagues, Iran is an annoyance, but what they're concerned about is how the heck are they going to handle the Brexit issue? That is it seems to me overwhelmingly the most demanding thing on their collective plate. Could be wrong, but I don't think that Boris Johnson is going to be. He's not going to be to Trump what Tony Blair was to George W. Bush.
But in some respects, he's already caught up in this. He fired his opponent, Jeremy Hunt, who was the foreign secretary, who was trying to negotiate a deal with the European Union that Britain is determined to exit to run a common a convoy or protection naval flotilla to accompany flagged tankers through the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. And Johnson has to sort through the issue of the Iranian tanker that was taken at Gibraltar and the British tanker that was taken in the Strait of Hormuz. So I don't think he can escape this, at least not in the short term.
Oh, no, I don't. This is a complicated situation. I don't pretend to understand Boris Johnson and what motivates him, but my guess is that the Brexit issue will be of such overriding concern that will lead Johnson and his cabinet to be other than completely confrontational with Iran. I may have been falling behind the news here, but as I understand that the Iranians have signaled that, give us our tanker back and we'll give you yours, and we'll make this thing go away. Now, whether the British government will be responsive, I don't know if they have been responsive to that, but that's a pretty logical way to end this, that particular element of this showdown in the Persian Gulf. We'll see what happens.
And, Professor, finally, I just want to get your comments on Venezuela. It is a complicated situation, and I'm not an apologist for the Maduro government, But I believe that it is more or less a legitimate government that is presiding over a serious economic crisis that's been driven by the long-term effort of the U.S. to take out the socialist governments in Venezuela and the slide in crude oil prices that sent Venezuela into a tailspin about 5 years ago. I've been really troubled that most Democrats are silent as Bolton and Pompeo, with Elliot Abrams in tow, have been threatening, and also the extra legal efforts of trying to inject this guy Juan Guaido as the instant president and claim that he's legitimate and Maduro is not. I mean, I think this has been a really comical episode that has left the U.S. Looking both weak and I don't know the right word, but the scheming of the U.S. using the Lima Group, for example, as a rump organization to displace the Organization of American States. I just feel this whole episode has been a real mess.
It is a mess. You and I may disagree on the sources of Venezuela's dilemma. I tend to think it probably domestic incompetence and corruption over a pretty considerable period of time, plus the drop in oil prices has put the people of Venezuela in this terrible situation. But yeah, so what are we doing? Nothing helpful, I think. But I don't know that there's anything we can do that's particularly helpful. It is a Lord knows, we would be ill-advised to invade Venezuela and spread democracy there. But again, I don't think it's going to happen. But to be honest, I have nothing useful. You know, I have no 3-point plan to address the Venezuelan crisis. At the end of the day, I do think it's one of these things that, however messy along the way and however sad, that the people of Venezuela are going to have to sort this thing out on their own.
Yeah, I think that is correct. Well, Andrew Basevich, thanks for spending time with me today. As I mentioned, I enjoyed your piece, and I will link to the piece in Tom Dispatch called The Great Reckoning for our listeners to absorb, and I'll look forward to your new book next January.
Okay, thanks a lot. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Andrew Basevich. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.